clap, 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 clap. Clap, 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 clap. Clap, 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 clap. Clap, 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 clap. Clap, 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 Sister Soul Sister, you are listening to Jen and the Film Critic. My name is Jen Blundell, and with me as always is my film critic Paul Salt. Say hi, Paul Salt.
Hello! I was desperately hoping that some more lyrics of that song would come to mind before you got around to introducing me, but it didn't. I just stared at you like a rabbit caught in the headlights.
Hey, Sister Soul Sister, better get that dough, sister.
I just don't think I'm cool enough to get these references.
It's from Lady Marmalade.
I think it's a 50-year-old song, but I'm just not there yet. I'm still on that Glenn Miller hit.
To each their own, Paul. I shan't judge.
I know. It's just what I've grown up with.
Jazz.
So funky.
Give me the cold, hard truth, Paul. How many films are we covering today?
Well, let's not get hung up on things like that.
No, maybe we should. I'd like to get hung up on it.
Well, look, the point is, the important thing is, that it's been a little while since we did this, mm-hmm. and we've got a lot to catch up on.
Yeah.
And I think maybe we should start with the biggest movie of the year, I think. We could probably already call it. It's an IMAX release. It's caused quite a stir on Twitter. That's right, we're heading back to the desert because it's Alex Garland's Civil War. And by desert, I mean the barren political landscape we now find ourselves in.
Okay, cool.
Yay!
Didn't realize this was out already.
Yes, it's out already. Yes, this is the story of a group of journalists. Mm-hmm. I could probably do with some character names, but I'm not going to use them because Kirsten Dunst is the head journalist playing herself. And yes, she picks up a little Kaylee Spaney and two other journalists that she's with, and the four of them journey across a America divided by civil war, various breakaway states, and a tyrannical president. And along the way, they experience all sorts of violence and chaos as they begin to, as Kaylee Spaney's character begins to sort of realize what it's going to take to become a war photographer and what she's going to have to sacrifice to do so. So we'll get the easy stuff out of the way, critically speaking. Easy. The film is breathtakingly realized. It's giant, ambitious imagery that manages to have this frightening, gritty realism without rehashing the green grass shaky cam and crash zooms that have dictated so many war films of the past 10 years. The action is just viscerally terrifying and really absorbing. Just anyone could just die at any moment. Wow. It's just really frightening without just killing off characters. It's just this palpable sense of threat.
Cool.
You know, the entire final act of the film is just this symphony of machine gun fire. And speaking of which, the sound of the film has this big Nolan-esque grandeur where every gunshot feels like just a roar of thunder. It's unbearably tense. In an instant, you can just be killed or maimed, and the film, although not overly graphic, you know, there's no Saving Private Ryan-style viscera, people getting blown apart kind of thing. It doesn't shy away from the brutality and sort of, what's the word? Impersonalness of modern warfare, where people just become nothing in an instant. Performances are all excellent generally, but especially our four leads. Dunst is fabulously cold as the war-weary photographer with a palpable sense of authority to her. Ooh. She just looks like she knows what she's doing here, and you have this great need for her to sort of offer a sort of reassuring steering hand through this really grim world. Wagner Moura has this, he plays a guy who's been in the game just about as long as Dunst and has replaced her sort of cold cynicism with a sort of madcap intensity and kind of lunacy, you know, where everything's a joke kind of thing and nothing's really serious, that makes him very exciting to watch without losing a sense of pathos for him because you know that this is just a survival tactic that he's adopted. Kaylee Spaney, earlier seen as Priscilla, sorry, I keep doing that. I keep going to say Priscilla, so she's playing Priscilla Scales. Priscilla. From the eponymous Priscilla.
From Elvis's wife.
From Elvis's wife, the great hit film by Francis Ford Coppola's daughter is.
Thanks, men.
She is just. Thanks, men. And thanks, men, for being such a critical and financial success that allowed this to happen. Kaylee Spaney, yeah, she's just someone to watch. She's proven once again to be this really subtly expressive performer where you think you have her nailed down, and then there's just so much going on, more going on with her than you realized. And that's a really exciting thing to see someone be able to do. And Stephen McKinley Henderson, who was cut out of some other movie this year, I forget which one, is just a beautiful, soulful man. And it's always a joy to see him work, especially when carrying just a broken heart with him, as he is here. He's just this guy who wishes the world was better. And it's always very devastating to see that. But the real controversy of this film has been in its supposedly non-partisan approach to portraying the American conflict.
Okay.
Garland was quick to say as much early on in the sort of press kind of tour to say, you know, we're not targeting anyone specific, and the film does avoid the specificity of the current state of America. But the president is definitely couched as a fascist.
Okay.
And the most villainous moment of the film comes care of a racist xenophobe.
Right.
So if you come to this with the thought that the president is Trump and the breakaway states are his own MAGA lunatics having turned on him and are now out for his blood, that read is never really challenged, I don't think. It's just never implicitly said that's what's going on. There is mention of an Antifa massacre, which may be a massacre of or by Antifa. We don't know.
Hard to tell,
but it's in there. So, you know, there are references made to the president bombing US citizens, ignoring humanitarian pleas, defunding the FBI, and lying to the public. So, oh, yeah, it could be either of them. But what we see in the film is a heavily armed military fighting a heavily armed general population. So to me, it did definitely just feel like a failed far-right state. Yeah. But, you know, then perhaps others will feel it invokes left-wing revolutionaries that have happened, you know, revolutions that have happened abroad, and will think it evokes that. So who's to say? But Garland, I think, wanted to make a film about the threat of an actual armed civil war in the streets of America. And, you know, so he sticks to broad themes of survival and a cycle of violence, you know, fudging the sort of motivational details, you know, in the hopes of making as many people see it as possible. There's a very telling scene in the film where our journalists get pinned down by a sniper.
Oh, yeah.
And they find some opposing soldiers are also pinned down. And they ask them what side they're on and who they're shooting at. And the response of the men is that it doesn't matter. You know, they've just got someone trying to kill them, and so they're trying to kill them first.
Yeah.
A reductive view of conflict, but not unfamiliar and not unrelatable, you know.
And I imagine when you're in the moment, it does come down to that.
Well, yeah, absolutely it will.
I'll work out who they were if they're shooting. I'll work out who they were later. If they're shooting at me now, let's deal with that first.
Yeah. I think soldiers are often asked that, you know, how do you feel about the ideological basis for the war that you're fighting over here? And it's like, I'm just fighting for the guys I know in this army.
Yeah.
You know, like I'm part of a squad. We're all friends and we're trying to make sure none of us die.
Yeah.
Often is what it comes down to. And, you know, the extent to which obviously there's a line there where you have to keep hold of your own sense of morality, even as a soldier. Otherwise you will just end up as sort of, you know, foot soldier of
doing a massacre
forces in the world. Doing a massacre. You'll do a massacre, and that's not a good thing to do, so don't do that. It's a pretty simple moral code for soldiers, I think. I'm sure it's easy to stick to that.
Yeah, easy peasy.
But the thing is, if this movie had been made overseas in another war, if this had been Lebanon or Syria, whatever, then the apolitical nature of it and lack of specificity would have been absolutely par the course.
Yeah.
It's just how conflicts are portrayed over there as a backdrop for a personal struggle.
Yeah.
But this film is set in America. And right now, a very politically fraught and frightening time. And so maybe it is a little disappointing to have a film that feels like it's towing the line.
Yeah.
Maybe you want something that is a little bit more outright in saying, hey, stop pushing it, guys.
Yeah.
Those of you with guns, quit it.
Yeah.
And one side definitely seems to have more guns than the other. So maybe you want more of a statement. But, you know, if you made a film that was overtly or even subtly anti-MAGA or anti-woke, half of your audience wouldn't see it.
Yeah.
You know, it's a lesson learned from the days of Soviet censorship. A generic humanist message broadcast can be a lot more effective than a strong partisan message shelved.
Yeah.
Or only showing in art spaces or, you know, as part of activist cinema. So I think the real casualty of the film may be the image of war reporters, because they're portrayed as cynical sociopaths who have completely abandoned all morality to effectively do their job, taking pictures of people as they lay dying and, you know, stepping into active fire in order to get the best shot. You know, we don't ask questions, Dunst says. We take pictures so that other people can ask questions. Yeah. Which, yeah, I'd be interested in hearing how war reporters feel about that idea of their role. But kind of that's Garland talking about his own role. Mm. You know, he is indifferently and apolitically capturing images of brutality, or in this case, regrading them, without comment so that others can comment.
Yeah.
You know, the film does lay out its intentions in dialogue quite a few times.
Yeah.
And in the same way the film avoids politics, the journalists move deftly from one side to another, claiming immunity, you know, with their press badges.
Yeah.
They work for Reuters,
yeah,
you know,
okay.
It's said at one stage. And although they are multiracial and mixed gender, the film is actually quite careful to portray all of the opposing armies as being the same.
Sure.
You know, all of the armies have, you know, people of different races,
yeah,
and
yeah,
genders. So there's no obvious sort of white guy side. Having said that, once again, the most frightening sequence of the movie involving Jesse Plemons is just a bunch of white guys killing people who are foreign. So...
yeah,
what do you, you know, yeah, it seems pretty straightforward, but it's a horror film, really. It's a horror film about the idea of the daily reality of those living in war zones coming home to the range,
mm-hmm,
in a sort of frightening sort of call to America to sort of try and wake up from the violence it seems determined to head towards. A little shallow, yes, maybe, but a brutally effective shallow in a political sense. It's not shallow in terms of personal stakes. A vague warning cry that's less curious about the systems that maybe produce societal decay, but very interested in the results and very revealing of the results. And perhaps that alone would be enough to pull some wool from some eyes. So I think I'm actually going to give it all 5 stars.
That's
because
fun.
It was just a most brutally, unrelentingly intense experiences that I've had in a cinema in a while. And I think it's quite striking.
Cool. Nice. Yeah.
Ugh. Do you think you'd see it?
Yeah, I remember seeing the trailer for this and thinking, weirdly, I usually wouldn't, you know, if you just described it to me, it's not the kind of film I would naturally, because I don't like war films. I
no,
don't tend
we
to
had
like,
this conversation about Dunkirk, I think.
Yeah, I'm not wild on war films. Too sad. I'm not.
This one's too angry to be sad, I think.
I don't often also enjoy, like, sort of dystopian, this is the end of the world, disaster films. That's the word I'm looking for.
Yeah.
Too sad.
Yeah. Yeah. There.
But this one, I saw the trailer and thought, that looks good. Like, I would I would like to see that. And then I didn't realize it'd come out so soon, so.
Hey. Yeah, it's already out. Go check it out, kids.
Go check it out. War's not glamorous, kids. Go check it out.
War isn't fun, and it isn't cool.
It really ain't.
No.
No.
So
don't do it,
Don't do it.
Mm-hmm.
It's part of what Dunkirk tells you. It's not cool.
Yeah, they made it so sexy in Dunkirk.
They made it so hot. They said Tom Hardy would be there.
Nah. Oh,
but
is Tom Hardy in this one?
No.
Okay, fine. Don't do it, kids.
So it's a devastating portrayal of warfare. But speaking of making things potentially irresponsibly sexy, I don't think that's what's happening here at all. We've got another big screen film that we need to discuss.
Yeah.
Long time fans.
That was my impression at the start of the film. Zoom gate that entirely.
That's actually really good impression of the music in this film, because long time fans have been waiting for it. Yes, it's Back to Black, the Amy Winehouse biopic. And by fans, I of course mean Amy Winehouse fans.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's the Amy Winehouse story. Mm. It's the story of her from her raggedy origins in a council flat to the rise to stardom and all the sort of trials and tribulations that awaited her there. All the little misadventures she had. I'm sure that most people are familiar with the story. So it's that. It's just a movie version of that.
Yeah.
And let's start positive. There's a sequence that works.
Okay.
It's the performance of the titular track, Back to Black.
Sure.
Obviously an incredible song. Mm. The music works. The montage communicates the mood well. The performance and framing of, I should get her whole name, Marisa Abela as Winehouse actually comes together and offers a sort of haunting visual of her face kind of, you know, frozen in this kind of performance state. And it does make you feel the kind of despair of the song in a way that I'll probably remember when I hear the song.
Mm.
You know, it's a good music video.
Okay.
Now, Marissa Abela certainly gives a committed performance. It's very big.
Mm.
But to me, at least, felt a bit forced. Okay. And it's tricky when you're dealing with a character who had such a big personality and such a unique look and voice. It's hard to do that and not seem like a caricature, and I'm just not sure she always stayed on the right side of that line. It's particularly since I grew up with people with Amy Winehouse's accent, you know? Grew up in London, so I know it quite well, so it's very tricky, you know, to have that sound completely natural to me. O'Connell plays Amy Winehouse's one-time husband, Blake Fielder Seville. And he's quite charming in the role, and the movie does come alive when the two of them get together, because they do have quite good chemistry. Mm. Eddie Marson and Leslie Manville are reliably good with the material given. So what's the problem? It just feels like a very conservative older person's idea of Winehouse.
Sure.
It's, oh, she, such a shame, isn't it? She had a lovely voice, you know, and she could have been such a lovely girl in her own way, but, oh, she had a temper on her, and she liked the drink a bit too much, you know what I mean?
Mm.
And, oh, the things she'd come out with, though, she was so funny. Oh, the things she would say. You didn't know what she'd say next. Still, it's not surprising how she ended up, is it? You know, if only she'd met a nice man and had a baby. That's okay. The vibe of the film. And I can't pretend to know too much about Amy Winehouse, but I am reliably informed that this film completely fails to address the role of her father, one-time husband, and the record label and producers and people who are supposed to be looking out for her, in encouraging or at least failing to address what happened to her because she may have been more lucrative as a mess.
Sure.
So I can see that pursuing that angle might lead to just portraying her as a victim of the men who were in her life and sort of disempowering her, and you don't want to do that.
Mm.
But in that case, you just got to get under the skin of Amy Winehouse. What was the black she kept returning to when the men left her? What truth was it that she kept capturing in her music, you know, that was born of all this suffering, that spoke to so many people? And if you can't find that story that absolutely has to be told with the urgency of a cry for help or a warning or a call to arms or a sermon, maybe just don't make the movie.
Yeah.
It just... I don't know. Zach Schoenfeld wrote a wonderful article for The Guardian decrying all of these biopics, you know, that have come out recently, stuff like the Bob Marley film and, you know, all the others, some of which we've talked about in this podcast, and praising Walk Hard, the Dewey Cox story, apparently a very prescient comedy, sort of parody.
Yeah.
And he described this deluge of music biopics that we're getting now as estate-sanctioned exercises in brand management.
Uh-huh.
And I think that's a good summary of why all these films feel so unutterably bland. You know, a biopic that's worth telling should piss off the subject or their estate a little bit.
Mm. Yeah.
I think that works, you know?
I think it's hard. It must be hard.
Yeah.
Especially if you're going to the family and being like, hey, can you tell me more about her? What she was like.
That's the thing. Is they it's not just the source of information, because you can make a perfectly good film without any of that.
Sure.
But they crave the legitimacy of it.
Mm.
They want the people, the survivors and their relatives, to come out and say, this is how it happened.
Yeah.
You know, come see this movie. And I don't quite, I don't know if that's bespeaking the obligation of cinema to truth very well.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think it's very good when you have people with the same surname as the subject showing up in the executive producer slots.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. A recent exception, I think, would probably be The Iron Claw, which I think was kind of vindicated by the guy himself, and obviously told a very fraught, real story about the pressures of that family were under. But I look at something like The Social Network, which, you know, has some serious faults in its portrayal of Mark Zuckerberg as being this kind of Sherlock-esque kind of, you know, genius. But it at least had the guts to portray him as a ruthless, misanthropic little weirdo. And not all biopics should be that critical of their subjects, absolutely. And I don't see, you know, there's too much reason to portray Amy Winehouse in that way. But they should find something to say about them, damn it.
Yeah.
I recently watched Todd Haynes' I'm Not There, which is a biopic of Bob Dylan.
Okay.
In which six different actors play different characters with different names that are all inspired by Dylan.
Oh, it started to rain. I hope you can't hear that on the mic.
Ooh. Oh, I can. It's a chill vibe. Yeah, welcome chill to this vibe. ASMR.
Welcome. There's a fireplace roaring gently in the corner.
Crackling away.
Someone's just handed you a hot cup of tea.
Yeah, there's a cat yowling because it's been left out in the rain. It's just the most relaxing sounds.
you okay, Paul?
I'm okay. Yeah. I know how to relax.
Bob Dylan, yeah.
Yeah, it's like it's Christian Bale, Ben Whishaw, Kate Blanchett
That's
plays
it.
Him for a bit.
I knew there was some weirdo.
Yeah, they're all doing their Dylan impressions and they're all playing different characters inspired by him. And it's a very experimental approach that was much more revealing, critical, inquisitive, reverent, celebratory, and somehow just honest than these bland, polished biopics will ever be. I don't know, but the thing is, so much of the marketing for this film, Back to Black, focused on the idea of Winehouse not being your typical pop princess.
Sure.
You know? I ain't no Spice Girl, she says at one stage, which is just maybe remember how much the voice irritated me. She's not a Spice Girl, you know. And so, and that her art stemmed from suffering, you know, she wasn't mass produced.
Sure.
And I can't help but feel that a more fitting tribute to Winehouse would be something perhaps a little bit more irresponsible, or at least willing to indulge in the things that excited her about life.
Yeah.
I don't know. Instead, we get something that's quite conservative about a funny and talented young woman who was cursed to be alternative. And if only she could have just had the kids and a nice man to save her. You know, but, you know, she had to deliberately live a terrible life so that we could have her music in the comforts of our own homes and our own regular lives that are probably, we should probably be grateful for.
Yeah.
You know, just everything about the styling and execution of the film is an outsider looking in. So, yeah, it's just the 2 stars.
Fair enough.
For this. It's, yeah, I don't think there's anything really good being added to it. And I can't see too many people really resonating with it.
Fair.
Ah. All right. That's correct. That is a good impression of King Kong. Because it's the
what
second installment
a
in a
make. Sorry.
Oh,
there we go.
There we go.
Sorry, let me just do it properly.
It's flawless. Yes,
thank you.
It's the second installment in a big sci-fi series focused on a romance from across the stars as they fight against a terrible empire at a terrible cost. This bit works funnier if I haven't already revealed that we're not talking about the thing. Yes, it's Godzilla X Kong, the new empire. Premise I've written.
Premise.
Oh, that's for me to describe the premise.
Yeah, do it.
King Kong has gone back to the Hollow Earth. There's a Hollow Earth, keep up.
Okay.
And he's gone back and he's living his day-to-day life in quite an amusing opening sequence. But he's lonely.
Aww, you would be though if you were a big old monkey. Ape,
he's
sorry. Apologies.
You're a big old monkey and all your friends are just stupid dinosaurs.
Tell me about it. Relatable.
I know. Bloody pterodactyls coming down here. The pterodactyl parents.
Mom!
So,
do your dishes.
Then, and it gets a little surreal, then he gets a toothache and falls into a hole to the earth.
Okay.
Where we fix his tooth and send him back and follow him, and as some human characters do, and yeah, continue our adventures. Meanwhile, Godzilla's kicking off a bit. Basically, there's a bad monkey who's king of a monkey empire, and King Kong needs to challenge him in order to become the good king of the monkey empire, and he's going to bring his best friend Godzilla to do it. That is the entire plot.
Oh, yeah, the trailer told us all that.
Yeah, there's also a little girl. So,
of course.
It's a big... it's a big monster movie, and an American one at that. It is therefore... very much as you'd expect. It has very Marvel sensibilities, undercutting any real drama with a joke. You know, the human characters are all kind of facetious, fast-talking, self-deprecating cliches with a sentimental subplot thrown in about, you guessed it, family.
Yep.
But who cares? Who cares about all that? Only losers like me long for the Japanese movies where the human characters have the relatively consistently sort of entertaining stories that keep you engaged with this actual... scenario. The American Zillas have always been about tedious human characters. You know, the problem with the MonsterVerse so far has been the amount of time they've forced us to spend with the likes of Kyle Chandler, Aaron Taylor Johnson, and Vera Farmiga. What do you mean you don't remember any of them being in these movies? They were. All of them were. And it's been a nightmare so far. So, you know, at least Dan Stevens doing a Chris Pratt impression is... I don't know how to finish that sentence.
It is. It really
is. It's bad.
Is.
It's bad, the humans are bad, but they are in far less of the movie than you would fear. Not as little as you'd like, but not as much as the previous installments, which is a blessing. You know, there's a big monkey and a big lizard, and they need to fight the big evil monkey and his pet lizard, and
excuse
that's
me,
what's going to bring people in.
Godzilla's not a lizard.
He's a kind of
a
lizard.
He's a kaiju.
Though. He's a kaiju, but they're all kaiju.
Yeah.
He's a lizardy kaiju.
No, he's not.
I think he's got cold blood or whatever it is.
He's a reptilian cat, and I'll hear nothing else against him.
I don't see Godzilla having any nipples. I never seen any nipples on Godzilla, so...
Yeah, that's the reptile side of him.
His name literally means something like... It's a mix between gorilla and whale.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, because he's the size of a whale, but he's like a gorilla.
I tried to... Yes, I had fun in Tokyo trying to find Godzilla-themed stickers for you in a shop. And Sarah was with me, and I went up to the cashier, and I very bravely managed to ask in Japanese. Don't ask me how they say. I said this. I had no idea how. And I managed to say, do you have Gojira stickers? Knowing that Gojira is the word for Godzilla. And she took me over to a load of them with whales on. And I was Then I Googled it, and I was like, that's also just the word for whale.
Yeah, you might have been better off just saying Godzilla.
Yeah, probably. Probably.
Godzilla wa genki desu. I think that's how is Godzilla. Anyway.
So desu ne.
So desu ne. Ii desu ne. So, I do think grounded is the better way to go when you've got big monkeys fighting each other. Because
he's
even
an
when
ape
you're ball. Aiming...
It's an ape.
Oh no!
He's not a
I can't get...
He's not a monkey.
The fans are going to come at me so hard for this.
This is monstrous. Even... What is this premise?
Even if you're aiming for ridiculous, play it straight, it hits harder. It's funnier.
Yeah, true.
You know,
true.
This movie doesn't play it straight, which means the silliness needs to become amusing in and of itself. Like, the idea of what they're doing needs to be funny. And to be fair, yeah, it kind of does. Like, when a big monkey uses his giant whip to lasso a skyscraper, uproot it, and hurl it at King Kong, who proceeds to punch it to pieces with his new big robot hand, which was actually attached to him as a treatment for frostbite... It's fun, because that's a fun idea.
Yeah.
It's fun to say and it's fun to see. It's not as funny or exciting as if you'd done that with all the gravitas of a Nolan film. Like, this is the most serious thing happening. That would make it a lot funnier, but it's a lot more coherent and enjoyable than the CGI nonsense of recent Marvel or any DC film, or indeed the other MonsterVerse films. The best MonsterVerse movie is still Kong Skull Island.
Okay, yeah.
That is still the best one, and although this is second best, it does feel quite far short of that movie.
Yeah.
This is entertaining, and I can attest that diehard Zilla fans will enjoy it. My flatmate Jack laughed all the way through and attempted to start a round of applause entirely on his own at the end.
Bless him. Bless you, Jack.
I would have joined him. I would have joined him, but it's better he learn.
Learn, Jack. Bless you, but you fool.
I enjoyed it too, and it's the most interested I've been in the American franchise since Skull Island.
Sure.
I'm about to give this stupid movie one more star than Back to Black, and I do worry about the optics on that in terms of what it says about me as a critic, but sometimes you have to judge a film on how well it achieves what it sets out to do.
I think that's fair.
Back to Black sought to accurately reflect the life of a creative figure. This movie set out to have a big monkey punch a dinosaur.
Yes.
And as mad as it seems, the difficulty in convincing an audience to care about either is just as steep. So I'm giving this 3 stars.
Fair.
Well, perhaps that isn't the movie you've been waiting for this year. Perhaps you're more interested in the sequel to a 2021 film that made quite a few waves. That's right, it's the much-anticipated return of Paul Rudd in Ghostbusters Frozen Empire.
Who are you going to call?
Ghost Paul Rudd!
Paul Rudd. That,
to be fair, that's a good impression of Slimer.
Yeah, thank you.
Oh, God. So, yes, premise. It's I just ran the word premise in. Premise! McKenna
There's
Grace
ghosts.
Is a young...
They bust them.
There's ghosts. They get busted. McKenna Grace is a young Ghostbuster, except she's too young because the guy who was the bureaucrat from the first one is now the mayor of the city.
Oh.
And he doesn't like the idea that McKenna Grace can just go out busting. So she's got to stay back at the firehouse whilst her family go out busting. And also there's a whole subplot where Ernie Hudson who now owns Ghostbusters.
Okay.
Has a side project going on that is far better equipped, even though they are not the field team, that features James Acaster and the girl from the last one doing research on ghosts. Meanwhile, also, Dan Aykroyd still runs that Ray's voodoo shop place, and Kamal Nanjiani comes in with a artifact that has an ancient ghost in it. Meanwhile, there's stuff going on with a frozen empire that's been released from an orb and is going to hurt everyone. It's very much a film of meanwhile and sure. then.
Sure.
I don't really know what this franchise is, and I'm not sure the people making it know either. The original film is a high-concept comedy, but undeniably just a comedy.
Yeah.
Very disposable, very fun. There's a throwaway moment where a newspaper spins at the screen that says, "Do ghosts have rights?" And it's amusing because you're not meant to think about it, really, because it's just exterminators with ghosts.
Yeah.
You know, every sequence was devoted to incredibly character-focused, dialogue-driven comedy. You know, occasional visual gags from the ghosts, but for the most part, it's just a group of talented comedians doing understated, naturalistic comedy yeah. with each other that's largely character-based. Now, there's no reason not to do new things and take franchises in new directions, but with Ghostbusters, the whole endeavor feels so deeply cynical. Mm. The fact that they've made such a supremely bland modern blockbuster and heaped on the sentimental treacle mm-hmm. as heartily as they have, treating every little scrap or artifact from the original films as this hallowed thing, just feels really manipulative. The comedy is not the set piece. The comedy is the default comedy of a modern blockbuster, very much like Godzilla X Kong. You know, what 10 years ago I would have called knockoff MCU, but it's now just MCU. I saw this in a room with about 16 other people, which wasn't great because it was bank holiday, it was Good Friday,
ooh,
okay. like the week after it came out, and there were 16 of us in there. And beyond a couple of titters, there was one big laugh involving Kamal Nanjiani going down a fire pole in a suit of armor.
Okay.
And it made a squeaking sound. That was our big laugh. Otherwise, just nothing. Nothing from all the just babbling that's been going on. And speaking of whom, Nanjiani plays the last descendant of an ancient order of Ghostbusters called the Fire Masters, and he has special psychic abilities to control fire. What is this franchise?
Yeah.
This was a parody of 80s Reaganomic businesses. What do people want from this? I've no idea. I don't think they have any idea. The fantasy elements and resulting expositional sequences are as inspiring as they are inexplicable. But you know, even if you find yourself making a Ghostbusters movie, and I'm sorry if that happens to you, every scene in your movie is an opportunity. If it's a comedy scene, a horror scene, a drama, every single scene is a chance to do something special. Make it stand out. Have an impact on the audience. You know, do something different. Throw their expectations. This might be a whole new standard for mediocre, perfunctory filmmaking. Not a single shot feels designed with artistic merit or intent. This is a corporate exercise through and through. You know, and walking out of the cinema with Katie, she was talking and I was hearing some of it. And she was saying,
I apologise, Katie, on Paul's behalf. It's despicable treatment.
It's despicable treatment of the dearest friend this podcast could ever have. And
you talking about my mum?
Well, yeah, her too.
Yeah, yeah.
I'd listen to your mum if she had something to say about Ghostbusters.
And so you should. Empire,
I would absolutely listen. But Katie was talking. And, you know, she said it had potential. And I hadn't seen any at all, so I asked her to elaborate. And she pointed to the sequences in which McKenna Grace bonds. She goes out to the park at night. Mm. And I think she thinks maybe she might see her father because there's a chess thing that happened in the first one that happens again. But instead, a very young ghost played by Emily Allen Lynn shows up in sequences that are really, that feel as though they're going to be romantic in nature.
Okay.
In some way, in a sort of queer romance kind of way. But they don't. Which is a bit of a shame, but there's something going on here. There's something quite good. Marginalized because of her age, but not connecting to her new stepfather because he's Paul Rudd. She finds she has more in common with the spirits that her family are intent on busting.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's a very generic Romeo and Juliet story, but there's some personal stakes up for grabs if you wanted to commit to any one thing.
Yeah.
But this movie just felt like, throw everything at the wall and see what sticks. If we keep them moving, they won't have time to think about any of it. And yeah, I want to rate this one harshly because this is the new standard of mediocrity. If you want to know what a blockbuster movie looks like in 2024, and you want to rule out any outlying talent or seldom seen glimmer of originality or inspiration that sometimes accidentally gets into these things, then you can hold up Ghostbusters: Frozen Empire. And also it wasted James Acaster, so it's one star.
Okay, interesting.
One dang star.
Interesting.
Didn't like it.
Oh. You don't say.
I know.
You should be more clear in your opinions then.
I should be.
Stop. Get off that fence, Paul. Yeah. No place for sitting.
It's just no place for sitting. And you know what? I've had enough of talking about monkeys and ghosts. Because we've got a huge movie to discuss.
Yeah.
Oh, actually, we are going to talk about Monkey because it's huge for Dev Patel because it's his directorial debut, Monkey Man. Yeah, Dev Patel stars as the eponymous Monkey Man, an underground fighter seeking revenge against the police captain who killed his mother. He works his way up through the underground crime world to become a waiter at a swanky club for corrupt politicians so that he can get close to his target. But when his first attempt goes wrong, all hell breaks loose. But with Diwali celebrations approaching, he finds allies that he never knew he needed.
Interesting. So,
yes, interesting.
I love immediately the concept that you start as a fighter, prove yourself to the criminal gangs, and eventually they might let you be a waiter.
That's exactly what happened. I don't know if his fighting activities are well known. I think he just comes in as just a random porter dude and busts his way up to waiter in a place where they do horrible things. So it's very familiar action movie sort of setup and premise. Mm. And the aesthetic and tone is familiar too. Sort of late night in a city, you know, kind of feel, neon stains, cynical, violent. You know, the fact that it's set in India, you know, obviously adds elements to it, but, it, you know, we know this kind of setting.
Yeah.
You know, but as an example of that sort of thriller, it's very effective and stylish. It's moody and it's dynamic and it's grim without feeling exploitative. And the action sequences are sparse. There's only a handful in the whole movie, but exhilarating. Mm. And that includes a really relentless, prolonged chase at the film's midpoint that just keeps escalating and getting crazier and crazier.
Ooh.
Bringing in stranger and stranger characters in a way that's very satisfying. And the choreography's good. And the camera work is frenetic without distracting from the action. And Patel is very convincing as this kind of Jackie Chan-style underdog who gets, you know, he's not the most talented fighter in the room. He just gets up again when he's knocked down.
Mm.
You love that in a hero. But where this movie pulls ahead from its competition and really finds itself is in its surprising sensitivity. Because you've got these beautiful and imaginative flashbacks to the Monkey Man's mother and the folk stories that she would tell. And it's surprisingly socially aware. You know, it's not content to just use India as an exotic backdrop. The film portrays a harshly divided, bustling city with massive income inequality, a caste system that excludes various people, and even the sort of blurring of church and state leading to corruption. And it also has a very well-developed and moving subplot regarding a community of marginalized transgender people who teach our hero to discover his true strength at the sort of third act of the film. So, this is everything you hope an action movie will be, but never reasonably expect that it could be or will be. It's, 4 stars for Monkey Man. I was really impressed by it. Oh, and Dev Patel is just charming.
Yeah, oh, he is, isn't he?
Yet another Skins alumni achieving extraordinary things. That show, man.
I never watched it.
Nor did I but the number of people who have come from it. Yeah.
Jeez.
Oh, I've seen clips of him in it. He's charming.
Mm.
He's so cute.
Yeah.
Now he's the monkey
charming
man.
And stuff.
Now he has a beard and wears a suit and kicks butt.
My internet connection has died temporarily. Oh,
no!
You've returned. I'm going to blame the storm that is blowing through and battering the house.
What's unusual is I didn't lose you for a second there. I got to experience every moment of that little episode.
How weird.
How bizarre.
You froze temporarily both times.
Oh, no.
Hey.
The storm battering the house, is it going to be a risk to life or limb?
No. House is solidly built.
Yeah.
Solid English work.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Bricks and everything. That.
Bricks?
I do my dinner off it. I mean, if you count me putting my dinner on a plate and then on a table that is then on the floor, that is the
house. I don't. I smear my baguette up the wall and eat off it.
Smear your baguette up the wall?
I smear my spaghetti up the wall and then eat it off that. That's how I eat off my house.
You should do. That is correct. That's how they do it in Italy.
Spaghetti hits the wall.
As long as you don't use a spoon, it's authentic.
You have to position, you lie on the floor with your mouth open and wait for it to drip.
Yeah, just don't, if you don't look, don't use a spoon, don't cut it up into small pieces. However else you want to eat it is authentic.
I feel like you eat it like Chinese noodles. You bring the bowl to your face and just like shove them directly into your mouth.
Yeah, except for instead of a bowl, it's the wall and you're licking it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that, of course.
That.
Parmesan, sir.
Yeah.
Just grate it straight into my gob.
We know how to do it. Per favore. Per favore.
Prego.
Oh, God. Yes. But perhaps, I don't know, perhaps you're more interested in crazy genre films about a sect of weird nuns who are hoping to bring about the Messiah for a messed-up breeding experiment, only to have their plans compromised by the unwilling mother of said Messiah. That's right, it's the latest installment in everybody's favourite franchise. It's The First Omen.
Are you kidding me? Is there actually a plot line like that in The First Omen?
There is.
Wow. Yeah. You're doing really well, Paul.
Thank you.
I don't want to like address the elephant in the room. You're doing a really good bit. I'm really enjoying it.
Look, sometimes that just doesn't get said enough in improvised comedy. I just want to let you know I'm really enjoying this bit.
Yeah, you know, usually we express it through laughter, but I just want to make sure you're aware. I'm not just laughing for the audience so they know it's their time to laugh.
Jen's laughing with me.
I'm laughing with you, Paul. How's it feel?
I feel so warm.
Yeah.
And protected from the scorn of others.
You should. You should.
Yay. Well, yes, this is a prequel to Richard Donner's 70s horror classic that I was absolutely obsessed with as a child, to the point where I memorized that weird little poem that gets said multiple times in the film. For some reason, I think I quite like the idea of being the Antichrist.
Yeah, that makes sense.
I might be a shy little nerd, but there's a weird thing in my hair that means that I can kill you all with my mind.
Yeah, I feel like that's what most children go through a period of thinking, isn't it? You find something where you're like, I'm special somehow, and someday someone will tell me how.
Exactly. That's the hope. It is very much a superhero movie. It's just a, you know, dark one.
Yeah.
So this film tells the story of a young nun, Nell Tiger Free, which I do think our friend Nell should marry as many people as possible to make that her surname.
Absolutely. Or she could just change that. She could just make that her surname.
I don't think that's possible in Australia. I think it's just marriage. So find a man named Tiger, find a man named Free.
Great.
And become Nell Tiger Free.
Great. Or we get Goodman to move back to the UK, change his name by deed poll, and then they can get married and she can take his seat. Because that's the only way Australia works.
Yeah. Based on how my knowledge of Australian immigration, that'll be fine. Yeah. We'll get that settled in the next 25 years.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah. Nell Tiger Free. She joins a very sacred order of nuns in Rome, only to become a foul of an insidious breeding plot that hopes to bring about the birth of the Antichrist. The Omen isn't... Yeah, it's an odd title, actually, thinking about it. The Omen isn't the Antichrist. It's just warnings. Winter warnings. The original Omen film. And it's going to suck trying to refer to that from now on, now that there's a film called The First Omen.
Yeah.
It's a brilliant horror film, or one of the best ever made. Mm. It's menacing, operatic, deeply unsettling in its bleakness, and it has that great Jerry Goldsmith score. Everything about it is great. There have been some very uninteresting Omen films made since.
Mm-hmm.
Some that aren't so bad. Sam Neill as the Antichrist was quite good, even if the film, I think, was less than. But whilst this film doesn't touch the sublime heights of the original, it is more effective than I feared it was going to be.
Uh-huh.
It's a modern horror film, so what you get is a genuinely affecting and disturbing visual that really creeps you out, but then there's the cheap jump scare immediately after.
Sure.
So you still have to have that, but at least the build-up is scary. One thing I will say, there is a pastiche of an iconic horror moment that I think I've actually shown you from Andrei Solovsky's Possession. Isabel Adjani...
In the corridor?
In the corridor in the subway.
Yeah,
yes.
That's very burned absolutely into my mind, Paul.
Absolutely. There's a pastiche of that, and it's like, you don't copy that moment.
No.
It's horror movie royalty, and it's incredibly distinctive. It took me out of things a bit, but it at least bespeaks that they're cribbing from the best.
Yeah.
It's a perfectly fine horror film, but in an oversaturated market, I think it stands out well enough. Perhaps not as much as you'd want, but it certainly doesn't disservice its very singular predecessor. So I think it's 3 stars. There's some very good scares in it that have stuck with me.
Cool. Fine. Good. I'm not going to watch it.
Fair.
Sorry, yeah, the fair. Only one I need to make clear, not going to watch this one.
Well, let's get another one of those out of the way then, because there is, of course, another notable movie that features a sect of weird nuns who are hoping to bring about their messiah for a messed up breeding experiment, only to have their plans compromised by the unwilling mother of said messiah. It's Immaculate.
Okay.
It tells the story of a young nun, Sydney Sweeney, as she joins a very sacred order of nuns in Rome, only to come afoul of an insidious breeding plot that hopes to bring about the birth of the Antichrist. It's one of those twin movie situations, I'm afraid.
Oh no!
Yep. And I actually like this one a bit better.
Okay.
The conceit is that they've convinced her that she's had an immaculate conception and is about to give birth to the new Jesus. And this leads to an interesting dynamic between her and the other nuns. Lots of envy, but lots of reverence and sort of creepy sort of Midsommar-esque cultiness. And the reveal of what the nuns are actually trying to do and how they've done it is extremely funny and twisted in a delightfully camp way. So I enjoyed that. Oh, God. Well, look, Sydney Sweeney is really great at inexplicably committing to this role that sees her undergo a great deal of body horror. And it's not a pastiche of anything. So take that, First Omen. It's a little unmemorable, perhaps. We've seen sort of nun movies like this, but, you know, that I am genuinely struggling to remember which sequences come from Immaculate or The First Omen right now. Mm-hmm. Nevertheless, it much more effectively plays into the current post-Roe versus Wade, you know, overturn pregnancy anxieties that America is experiencing. And I think it's, you know, not a coincidence that these movies about freaky pregnancies are coming to light now. You know, we've also just had Birth Rebirth as well, which I haven't gotten around to reviewing for this podcast, actually. Oh. It was very good. But yeah, thank God body autonomy is safe here in the UK if you're over 25. And yeah, I guess the one comforting thing about the awfulness of our times is that horror is going to continue to get better and more relevant as we go. That's not a comfort for most. Anyway, you can take your pick of the months. I'm so sad, but you can take your pick of the nuns of the month's nun-themed pregnancy horror movies, because they are both far better than I expected they would be. 3 stars.
Okay, great. Yeah. I'll take neither for 50 points, please.
Yeah. Well, mothers, though. Am I right? Though. They would do anything to keep their children safe. Anything.
Uh-huh.
Mother's instinct.
Okay, great. Yeah.
Okay. Anne Hathaway and Jessica Chastain play mothers of two boys in an idyllic suburban American neighborhood in what feels like the 1950s. But when one child tragically falls to their death, the mother holds the other the mother of the dead child holds the other mother responsible, and begins acting sinisterly. Or does she?
Oh.
Is it all in the second mother in this scenario? I should have learnt character names. Head.
Yeah.
Who's to say? It's one of those gaslighty thrillers where you never know if there's something really to be afraid of and who's going to turn out to be the real villain in the end, the grief-stricken neighbour or our increasingly paranoid lead.
Ooh.
Now, this seems to have been a bit of a passion project for Hathaway and Chastain, who are also both producers on the film. And they, you know, the director is this cinematographer, and it does lack a strong style or sort of a unique style. Mm. Instead, mainly focusing on the performances and dialogue sequences to deliver the drama and thrills. So, you know, what's in it for them? It seems like they've really gotten this over the line and sort of had quite a bit of creative input. Well, this is high camp melodrama, where both leads are hamming it up, and in spite of the very serious subject matter, seemingly having quite a lot of fun, being duplicitous and menacing and giving each other the side eye. You know, it's very big. And I did wonder during the film which role would be the more fun to perform, but then the third act very much answered that for me.
Okay.
Having said that, we are dealing with child death and resulting trauma, and even though it's a soap opera and a sort of dark comedy, hand that rocks the cradle style, you know, madness, there are moments that you do feel the weight of what's really happening, and it genuinely, you know, feels moving. But for the most part, it's quite a silly drama that plays really well to a crowd. There were lots of laughs and gasps from, you know, people in the room.
Sure.
And that was a stark contrast to the icy silence of Ghostbusters Frozen Empire. So it's 3 stars.
Okay, fun.
Yeah,
good for you.
I enjoyed it, and I think other people will too. It's a very much an airplane movie kind of thing.
Sure, yeah.
You know, but it was good seeing it with a crowd, I would say.
Mm. Yeah, but a crowd tends to help most things, though, doesn't it?
They do, but well, I mean,
well, if you've got a good, yeah, if you've got a full crowd, usually by the time you've got a full room, you've got enough people in there that someone, like, it's, you know, pressure of numbers will help build things up. If you've got 16 of you in there, that's not, I'm not calling that a crowd.
No.
That's just a few other people in a big empty room.
Three's a crowd, but 16 isn't.
No.
Oh, God. It must be terrible to be the... Oh, okay, this was before I inserted Mother's Instinct in between this and the two non-related horror films. Fun. Mm.
Well.
But yes, it must be terrible to be the mutated messiah of a strange sect of people.
Yes.
Fated to bring a dark victory to the people of the world. Good thing none of that happens to David Dasmalchian in Late Night with the Devil.
Okay, great.
Now, you can actually read my full review of this film on Screen Mayhem, where I took the time to write a review in a bit more detail than I usually do. I refer to M.R. James and everything.
Wow.
Yeah. Actually, research. I thought about putting a footnote in. I didn't.
Wow.
I never would, but I thought about it.
I'm proud of you for thinking about it.
But in short,
yeah.
This is a found footage horror film purporting to be a show... purporting to show the last ever recording of a troubled talk show host who may have made a Faustian deal to try and save his career, and now, in this Halloween special, he shall have his comeuppance.
Ooh,
I really like the setup to this. It's very similar to Ghostwatch. You know, it's all meant to be actual footage of this recording.
That's fun.
It is fun. It's a bunch of skeptics and frauds gathered together for a trite evening entertainment show, except that something real is happening and nobody is prepared for it.
Spooky.
It's spooky. It's a good premise and it's fun to see it play out. Fun. And it's very well acted throughout the cast, but especially David Dasmalchian, who, you know, do you know who this is?
Like, I do, yes.
Yeah, yeah. He's
Sarah Keep is a big fan.
Sarah Keep is a big fan, and rightly so. He's always good in everything
she
shows up in.
David Dasmalchian. That's why I know who he is. I've looked him up several times.
Well, he's been very memorable in things like The Dark Knight and, you know, Oppenheimer and that space opera thing from a few years ago. So it's really good to see him step into the lead,
fun.
You know, because he's playing this fragile man who's trying to hold it all together. He's not a bad man, but he's a thoroughly corrupted and compromised one who has completely abandoned any sense of principle that he had. And the pacing and escalation of the horror is very good, pulling you along and gradually building the menace. And I really like the evocation of time as well. The atmosphere and aesthetic is very 1970s, until it isn't.
Okay.
Firstly, you have these rather hideous and very notorious now AI-generated artworks that are present throughout the film in the sort of backdrops.
Okay.
And I'm hoping that if this movie succeeds in becoming a cult hit, that boos should be elicited whenever this stuff shows up. Because, they should have paid an artist to do that.
Oh, I see. Yeah, okay.
Yes.
So it's not intentionally creepily AI.
They cheaped out, and it's really weird because, like, people online are pointing out they would do it for 50 quid if you gave them the right thing. It's literally just a picture of a skeleton and a pumpkin that's, like, in the background.
Sure.
And then is used in, like, the graphics for "We'll be right back." You know, just on screen for a few seconds, but it's very distracting how poor they look.
Yeah.
You know, it's just...
It's becoming increasingly easy to, like, identify AI art.
I know, right?
And, it's garbage.
It's becoming increasingly easy to recognize, but it's also becoming more insidious.
Yeah,
like, if
true,
Google
true.
Bela Lugosi right now, unless this has changed in the last few hours, the first result is an AI-generated image of him.
Really?
That looks terrible.
Oh, yeah.
It's still the case.
No, wait. If on the main... it's hard to tell. Yeah, if it's just on the all...
You're not
image,
seeing it. Trust
no,
me, if you...
Is it this one? It's hard... Are you talking about that one?
Yeah, that's the one.
Yeah.
That ain't Bela Lugosi.
No, that looks... That's... Yeah. That looks like AI art to me.
Yeah, it definitely is. And it's rubbish. So,
yeah, it's rubbish.
That's a shame that that's in here. Then there's the scares themselves. Moments where the special effects have to step in. And although there are some excellent practical effects and some very imaginative moments of gore... They are all supplemented by these CG effects like lightning or rays of light coming out of her head that's split open kind of thing.
Okay.
And they do remind you that you're watching a Shudder movie. And it does cheapen the experience a bit. And I'd have liked some more subtly menacing moments. Early on in the film, and this might just be me, but there's an audience member in a frightening mask who is not participating like the other audience members are. So you kind of get drawn to him and you think, who is that? You know, is there going to be a reveal?
Yeah.
When, you know, little things like that, things that The movie allows you to miss things that you notice, but you know the main characters haven't. There's loads of them in Ghostwatch, and I think I enjoy that in a horror movie and would always like to see more of it. And it does also explain a little too much of itself up front. It has this mockumentary opening that basically lays out everything about our main character and his ghosts, which may have been a little more interesting to have learnt throughout the film.
Sure.
So I found it a little frustrating because it had a lot of potential, and I wanted to see it realized. But it's a very effective horror and definitely stands out amongst Shudder's usual fare. So I'm going to say 4 stars.
Okay. Well, yeah. Good for you.
I want to be a little generous to this one because it's a good idea and it's fun to watch. But yeah, there are issues that disappointed me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I looked up the pictures of the AI art.
Yeah. Yeah,
if
right.
If you saw it like as a tiny like preview image on my phone, I'm like, weirdly, that doesn't look too bad. You open the image and you're like...
Yeah,
I mean, that's not how you draw a skeleton.
No, and there's a weird splotch of white that's nothing.
That's AI art for you.
Yeah. Just, wowee. Oh, God. It doesn't even look like it had a tidy up after getting the AI to generate the essential image. It's just bizarre.
Yeah.
All right, look.
Ooh.
Let's stop messing around.
Mm-hmm.
June part 2.
Okay, yeah. Don't just say it already.
Sorry, I misread it. That says Lisa Frankenstein.
Okay.
Diablo Cody has written another horror film to be massively undersold and missold by its marketing, but is sure to become a cult hit in about 10 years after she made Jennifer's Body. This time it's directed by Zelda Williams, the actor, director, and director of various shorts, and Robin Williams' daughter.
Ah.
But she certainly made a bit of a name for herself here, and I'm very interested to see what happens next with Zelda Williams. So the start of the whole... Oh, star, that's meant to be. You know what? There's nowhere to put premise, so let's do it. Do I? I think I kind of do it naturally. Let's find out. If you decide that you... If you feel like you'd like to hear the premise, let me know. The real star of the whole show is Catherine Newton. She plays Lisa Frankenstein, a high school student who finds herself on the outside due to her morbid fascinations, some of which stem from the axe murder of her mother 2 years earlier.
Ugh.
She then decides to resurrect a Victorian poet using a malfunctioning tanning bed, and chaos ensues. You start to get the idea
yeah,
of the kind
okay.
of tone of this movie. So, for all of the zaniness and madcap humor that goes on, it is Newton that keeps you grounded. She's charming and funny and even sympathetic, even as she gets more and more reckless, you know, and starts killing people. She understood the assignment
Spoilers.
Based on the trailers for the upcoming Abigail, I think she might be one to watch, which is good because I really liked her back in Paranormal Activity 4 way back in the days. And she was similarly Machiavellian and freaky when she's swapping bodies for a serial killer. And I was worried that she was going to get absorbed into Marvel after Ant-Man whatever. But she seems to be going the alternative route now, which is a very good thing, and I wish her the very best. But I think that this film achieves, Lisa Frankenstein achieves exactly what it needs to. It's messy, tonally all over the place. It's over the top. It's darkly funny, but in quite a juvenile way. And I think this is going to connect with alternative gothy teens in a way that... Heathers did, or The Craft, or Ginger Snaps, and yes, Jennifer's Body, you know, for the few teen girls who made it past the teen boy oriented marketing for the film. the gays saw it.
fair.
And you know, they're glad they did. Many it had a rough time with the critics too, but it's bound to. This isn't for them. This isn't for me. It's bright and silly and stupid and goth and stupid enough to connect with the young and young at heart. As to whether they'll find deeper meaning in it when they get older, I'm not sure. But a lot of teens are going to feel very seen by this film.
Oh, fun.
And are going to enjoy it a lot. I would have, certainly, as a kid. So I'm going to give it 3 stars.
That's cool. I saw a post on somewhere on Reddit the other day that was talking about like what are... the like iconic teen films for Gen Zers.
Okay.
And part of the argument was that some Gen Zers were, you know, alive, like they're not that much younger.
Yeah.
And part of it was that some people just watched, also were still watching 10 Things I Hate About You.
Sure.
And then someone pitched Pitch Perfect as an iconic series. But it would be fun if this became like a film, you know, if it's like very
I think so.
Resonates with teens, it would be fun.
Yeah, I think alternate teens certainly. Movies like Bottoms maybe has a better shot. you know, of making that kind of thing hers. Sort of these, you know, big teen. And there's something else as well that I can't put my finger on. There's been another American high school movie. There was Mean Girls the Musical, but that's not connecting with anyone.
Yeah.
Maybe it was Bottoms, I was just thinking of. But yeah, movies like this, I think they are around, and it'll be interesting to see what pops up.
Yeah.
In about 10 years, I think part of what's interesting to me, becoming older as a film fan, is seeing the stuff from about 10, 15 years ago that people are suddenly bringing back up again. Mm. Because I don't know if I knew The Mummy would become such a big part of my life as I got older. But to see people now sort of gravitate towards movies of the 2010s and late noughties and saying, actually, this is great. It's like, okay, interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting pick.
Yeah. Interesting.
And I'll be curious to see what happens with that going forward until I die. Then I don't get to find out after that.
No, you don't. Unless I bring you back.
Oh, that'll be good. In a haunted tanning bed.
Yeah, Ouija board. I was going to ask. Ouija board, haunted tanning bed, or like devil pact? Which one do you want?
I feel like somehow I will just haunt a kebab kitchen.
Yeah, that seems fair.
I don't know what I'm going to do there. I'm just going to compliment people. Ooh, good choice.
Ooh, I'd recommend some spicy mayo with that.
Don't use too much chili sauce. Ooh. Let the meat speak for itself. Well, Let the meat speak for itself is what I'd write above the kitchen in the Polarplex.
I thought you meant like in the steam in the kitchens of the kebab shop you're haunting.
Next to the junior kebab chef I've got because I thought he was massacring.
He went to oversalt it.
Speaking of movies that make me feel seen, how about a movie from a fantastical world, a world like ours, but with differences to help us to understand the universal issues and maybe even something that young people can enjoy and understand, some pretty big concepts. Robot Dreams. It's only loosely related to Dune now.
Yeah.
To be honest, I wish I'd found a way to make the Lisa Frankenstein one last. Anyway, that would have involved moving my spreadsheet around, and I'm not doing that.
Don't do it.
Never. This is a really endearing animated movie set in an alternate 80s New York populated by animals. And in this city, Dog lives alone, watching the TV and eating microwave meals and seeing happier people outside of the window. And then one day, he sees an advert on TV for a new robot friend. So he excitedly calls the number and awaits the postman, assembles his new friend, and then turns him on. What ensues is a great summer full of fun, games, trips, and then ultimately, heartbreak. Aww. As the two find themselves separated, they must learn to pass the time and live life to the fullest until they can be reunited. And I, with a film like this that moves me so much, in spite of being a sort of big, bright animated kids film, you do wonder if, you know, this is one of the best family movies ever made, or if it's just a family movie that's been made for adults.
Sure.
In an attempt to kind of disarm their cynicism with a wholesome approach and style that takes them back to a more innocent time of their lives when messages could be consumed a little easier, you know. And I saw it in a room full of kids, and although several had to be carried out by their parents at various stages, they were soon brought back, and I have to assume that this is just part of their normal operation.
Yeah.
You know, certainly it held their attention, that there was no running about, no noise. They seemed to be involved. And something that I think helps with both of these aims, you know, bringing joy to joyless adults and keeping kids involved, is that the film is silent. You know, with so many modern family films bombarding kids with noise and relentless dialogue, you know, hell, adult movies too, it's really nice to have a film that trusts in its visual storytelling. And I really hope that young audiences see this and connect with it, because this is the kind of wonder and joy that comes so naturally from cinema, but so rarely done with this level of conviction. You know, it's like silent cinema, or Wallace and Gromit even. It's just, it's the kind of innovation that Disney and Pixar used to at least do in their shorts. I'm not sure if they still do. Now I think they just stick The Simpsons in it. But what's at the heart of all this talent is a really sweet and affecting story about friendship and relationships. And it's communicating quite a challenging message. The same message as Toy Story 2, actually, that relationships end eventually. But that doesn't make them worth less.
Yeah.
You know, life goes on and you should be open to that. It's a very sweet but quietly devastating film. So that's a 5-star.
Aww.
Yeah.
Cool.
That's so sweet. I loved it. I think you'll love it too.
I think I will.
Yeah.
It's going to make me cry.
It's going to make you cry. It's going to make everybody cry.
Brutal. I'll do it though.
Good. Now the film directed by Denis Villeneuve. Oh wait, that says Alice Warraker. It's Alice Rorica is what it says.
Right.
It's La Chimera.
Okay.
A film I think I mentioned to you the other day. It's a film about a maverick archaeologist who works outside of the law to raid various tombs and give those treasures to a museum for a fee, a high fee, through the black market. Yes.
He's
Indiana Jones is not. Our hero is a very morally ambiguous figure played with great skill by Josh O'Connor, who has this kind of cynical kind of, he's this British guy overseas in Italy,
sure.
and has this supernatural ability to sort of detect where these treasures are. And yeah, so much of the film is about him sort of settling in, getting to know the various characters around him, and portraying this very interesting sort of disaffection that he has, but also this need to be recognized for this skill that he has. It's a gorgeous looking film. It's set in the 70s and it has this beautiful aesthetic with this big film grain kind of feel and very vibrant colors. It's really evocative of the space that it happens in. I'm speeding up a little because we still have a few to do. It's a five-star movie. I really loved La Chimera. It's a movie that I really enjoyed just settling into and has, but it also, it does bespeak the sort of devastation of, I don't know, like converting your passion into money.
Okay.
Because
sure.
he really does care about these treasures, but in having to seek them out in order to sort of earn money and to show off his sort of abilities, he is destroying them as well.
Yeah.
And, you know, kind of demystifying them and opening up tombs in a way that disrupts and upsets some of the group, because it's kind of, you know, ghoulish to be doing this and to be raiding the past for personal gain. So, yeah, it's a very morally ambiguous story, but one with some really breathtaking moments and, yeah, just a great spirit to it that I really enjoyed. So
cool.
Yeah. La Chimera.
Nice.
Yeah. Right. Timothy Chalamet.
Sure.
Starred in Wonka with Olivia Colman, who stars in this new film, Wicked Little Letters.
Yeah. Okay. Great.
Yeah. So, yes, this is the true story of a small community which was absolutely wrapped by the controversy of a member of the community who suddenly was receiving incredibly harsh, weird letters that contained some really foul but very bizarre language, and suspicions soon fell on a young Irish mum, played here by Jessie Buckley. It's a very good film. It's a film that feels as though it's going to be that kind of sentimental British film that comes along, sort of made for the mums kind of thing, but with the cheekiness of the swearing involved.
Sure.
But, you know, Olivia Colman's doing it, so it's fine. and it certainly has that, and it has those elements. But I really enjoyed all of the lead performances. I thought they were all very good. I found the story to be quite interesting. It's certainly getting to the heart of something in terms of the sort of constraints that are put on women and how they're expected to act.
Yeah.
There's a lot going on there, especially a sort of older women. But I did feel, and couldn't help but get away from the idea, that there's a darker film beneath the surface here. Yeah. Especially, there's a final shot of Olivia Colman which could in the right hands have been quite menacing, but because this is that kind of movie, it's got the music going and it's got reverse shots of Jessie Buckley smiling, and it's all very, you know, you did it, you finally made it. And it's like, did anyone like, was the benefit of this, or was this actually quite a troubling story in the end? You know, I want to highlight a few more performers. Joanna Scanlon shows up and is excellent, as she always is. Very funny. I really want to get this character name. Where are you? Yep. Anjana Vasan plays Gladys Moss, the police inspector who's sort of constantly looked down upon by her colleagues. She's the first sort of women's police officer expected to sort of do women's duties, such as, you know, things that women would be uncomfortable talking to men about, but she's just excellent. It's a movie that's saying all the right things. It's just doing so in a slightly twee way that could have, I don't know, hit a little harder. But as a comedy and as a drama, I'm sure it's going to hit home with the right audience. So it's 3 stars.
Nice. Very nice.
Yeah.
Oh, good. I'm glad. I saw the poster and assumed it was like a British twee sort of thing. You know,
it's
some comfy Sunday watching.
Yeah.
But which is, you know, there's nothing wrong with that, but I thought it would be a bit more on the twee side. But it's nice to hear it's
I liked it. I was surprised by it.
Cool, good. There's me judging books by their covers, and by books I mean films, and by covers I mean advertising posters. Which arguably should be judged, because they're supposed to sell it exactly on one image. But hey, anyway.
Well, indeed. Oh god. But you know, on the planet Arrakis, there's a lot of conflict.
Mm-hmm.
But in rural Japan, there's a more subtle conflict playing out. Yes. In Ryosuke Hamaguchi's Evil Does Not Exist.
Ah, okay.
Yeah. This is another film that I've recently done a written review of, so please check that out on the website. I go into all sorts of details about gentrification and that sort of thing. But suffice to say, this is a very...
That's Screen Mayhem. ScreenMayhem.com.
ScreenMayhem.com, you'll find it.
Great,
it's the last two things I wrote on there. I think it was like 3 weeks ago, so go nice. Find it there. Yes, it's a movie about two employees who are tasked with going to a small mountain community in order to assure the locals that building a glamping spot in their community is going to be a good thing for everyone, and sort of try and hand wave away some of their concerns. The movie spends a fair amount of time in that community and then following the lives of these two people as they try and do this terrible thing. Mm. And the conceit of the film is that evil does not exist. Everybody is following orders. Everybody's trying to please the higher-ups.
Sure.
And ultimately, there is human hearts beating at the heart of this whole thing. But there's also, just off-screen, something menacing, something primal, something about the nature that they're trying to disrupt that they don't understand, that they are going to upset. There's a sense of menace to the whole thing that builds throughout to this really mesmerizing and quite confronting ending that I really enjoyed. There's a lot going on there. There's a lot to be said about the way in which the world is being exploited, about the way in which the world is getting smaller, about the sort of destructive effects of late stage capitalism. But it's a very human story which doesn't have any easy answers to it. So yeah, it's 4 stars. I really enjoyed.
Cool.
Really enjoyed that.
Well.
Yeah.
I mean, great. Good. Sounds challenging.
It does. And confronting.
Confronting.
And exciting.
Ooh.
And good.
And also good.
I also think it's good. I think we should talk about June Part 2. It's Wim Wenders' Perfect Days.
Oh.
Oh, God.
I didn't realise that was this new.
Yeah.
That was so new.
It's yes, it is. Well, we're getting there.
I thought it was older.
Well, check it out on Mubi.
Or at the cinema, I guess.
I mean, we are back in March.
Oh, okay. But still.
But still, yes, it is. Yeah. Things move quickly when you're Mubi. So, yes, this had a relatively short cinematic release, I think, but it was
okay.
I'm very appreciative to have caught it there, but really there's no bad way to have watched this. It's wonderful. It's Hirayama is the character's name. He is played by Koji Yakusho, and he is a toilet attendant. He just spends his days tending his plants, reading books. It's a beautiful film about just a guy living a very humble life, and I think that is the really confronting part of the film. It's the challenging nature of contentedness.
Mm.
Because there's various implications about the life that he could have lived, about the things he could have done, or the things that he might be running away from, potentially, which is a very Wim Wenders theme. If you remember Paris, Texas, he does like to tell stories about people fleeing various forms of sort of social constraint that they are ill-equipped to deal with. I think that's quite a telling thing for a director of the German New Wave, where a great deal of that wave was defined by not wanting to fit into a system that only recently contained Nazism.
Yes.
It's quite a reasonable rejection of their parents' world, I think. And so, here you find a gentle soul living on the fringes of society. I say the fringes, he lives in the city, commutes in every day, and sort of is working, you know, amongst these various, you know, toilets as an attendant. Mm. And just the care with which he works, the care with which he lives his life, the routines that he's dedicated to. It's a very meditative kind of film, a very gentle film that is still enticing and engaging when you see little glimpses of the lives that are existing just outside of his view. It's very endearing. It recalls Jim Jarmusch's Patterson in that sense, just another movie about a gentle life well lived. But I said confronting and challenging because, I don't know, maybe this is just me, but the expectation for you to do something with your one life on this earth, to get out there and make a name for yourself, to leave some kind of legacy, is ever present and quite intense. And obviously a lot of our media is quite focused on the people who have done that. And so the ability to just say, I'm just going to live quietly and simply and happily, it almost feels like a risk, like a square to put your chips on. and hope that that pays out, and then by the end of your life you'll be happy about it and not regret the things you chose not to do. You know, for the perspective of this character, this has worked out well for them, and you just hope that maybe you could take a few aspects of his life and live that way too. It's 5 stars. I absolutely adored it, and I can't wait to see it again. But yeah, it certainly led to me asking a lot of questions of myself and my way of life.
Yeah, I think I'd find that very interesting.
Yeah.
Such a strange thought, isn't it? The idea that we're afraid that we might just have an enjoyable, quiet life.
Right.
then get to the end and go, you know what? I did all enjoy all of that, and that's the principle by which I lived my life.
Yeah.
But I do wish I'd set up a charity.
Well, it's more cynical than that. It's more the idea that I might get to the end of my life and think, oh, if only I'd networked more.
Yeah. It's weird.
Like, I don't know. Like, can I just continue going to the cinema and being happy?
I think it's a. It's when you break it down to like you're never gonna regret just having had a nice, happy life.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's hard to wrap your head around that, isn't it? There's such an instinct.
Because I always base quite a lot of my life and my decision making on the idea of I want to avoid regretting this later.
Yeah.
And that can be a good instinct. It can lead to you agreeing to some things that perhaps you were worried about agreeing to.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and just being like, oh, I'll do this because I might not have the opportunity to do it later. But yeah, it does mean that sometimes when I'm in a contented moment, part of me will be thinking, well, isn't there something more you should be doing? Are you going to regret this contentedness later?
I think you have to make sure you're not just doing, pursuing contentedness because in reality you're afraid of the chances of failure or
that's true
or having to do something uncomfortable. If you're doing it entirely because you are genuinely just happy with what you're doing and you don't want for more, then great,
that's it.
It's finding that balance is very difficult though.
It is, and knowing
not for me
difference.
Of course
no
because
I'm
perfect, but
that's true.
No,
hyper realized person.
Yeah
I could talk about another hyper realized person. Because I tell you, spice sure does crazy things to a young person.
Yeah.
And so does disaffection. This is The Sweet East.
Okay.
A immensely interesting, surreal film from Sean Price Williams, formerly a cinematographer who's worked with some interesting people over the years, now makes his own sort of debut. And it's, okay, so we have a young woman, Talia Ryder, as Lillian. And she is on a boring school trip to Washington, D.C., which she doesn't want to be there for. And then she goes into the bathroom, and we've seen her sort of milling around, having moments. And she goes into the bathroom of this club and starts singing.
Okay.
And that's what tells you, hey, you're not ever going to know what's about to happen in this film.
Right.
No more musical, no more songs. That never happens again.
Okay.
She walks out on the school trip, falls in with some Antifa people,
right,
followed by a white supremacist she hangs around with for a bit, and then she'll wander off and spend some time with some monks, with some Islamic terrorists, just wandering across this bizarre, slightly extreme version of America in this kind of Civil War light way.
Okay.
I saw a film critic refer to this as like the annoying teen on the train playing their stereo out loud, because although it's irritating, you do partially have to respect the audacity of them.
Yeah.
And I think that might be similar, and maybe this is a movie that young people will resonate more with older people, because it is dipping into a lot of things without really paying the price for having dipped into any of them.
Sure.
It's treating the world like it's you know, oh god, garden, I guess, picking flowers where it will. I don't, why was that like a buffet? That would have been fine. Buffet would have been fine.
Picking flowers where they will,
picking flowers out of the garden like we all like to do in gardens, but don't, because we understand what the cost of that is.
Yeah. That's a barren, bare garden.
You don't want a barren, bare garden that looks like Arrakis. So whatever that
Arrakis?
Is yeah, I don't know what that is.
I heard
some teenagers saying it, so I thought I might say it too. And this is the kind of movie you love to hear teenagers talk about. I've lost the plot. I really enjoyed this. It was a madcap sort of journey through America, and I think it does bespeak certain anxieties about the current nation, but also it's just a surreal, very entertaining, gorgeous looking sort of treat for the senses. So yeah, I liked it quite a bit. A bizarre sort of Alice in Wonderland style adventure through a surreal American landscape. 4 stars.
Cool. What did you say this one was called again?
The Sweet East.
The Sweet East.
Yeah.
Very cool.
Good. It's just sometimes if you're young and in love and equipped with still suits, you feel like you could take on the world.
Yep.
Just like the characters of Driveaway Dolls.
Yep.
Wait, we'll get it.
I've changed. I've flipped on the
You've changed, Jen. Jen, you've changed, but don't worry. We're going to cross back across the line at some point whilst discussing the next 7 films. I'm kidding. You genuinely died there. It's 10. Let's get on with it. Ethan Coen, newly separated. I'm just looking at the poster for Driveway Dolls. It's very good.
Look at it.
Have a look at the one on the Wikipedia page. It's good. Ethan Coen, freed from his brother, has decided to work with another relative, the hack, his wife Trisha Cook, who with whom he has written the screenplay. He has directed this on his own. The movie stars Margaret Qualley and Geraldine Viswanathan. Go on a road trip together, essentially just to get away from things, I believe is the plan, but they don't realize that actually they've become involved in a madcap adventure.
Cool.
Margaret Qualley is determined to get her friend laid. They're both lesbians, incidentally.
Cool.
But she's not too fond on doing that, just wanting to be herself, so there's a lot of sort of tensions there. It's very eccentric and very silly without being wildly successful for me.
Sure.
I was very endeared by the 2 lead performances. I thought they were great. By and large, like, there was some just very surreal little details in there. Odd transitions that feel very older director has discovered what digital technology can do. Had twixt about it.
Sure.
Just felt very carried away with the possibilities that are offered by this very basic editing software kind of feel.
Like when you make your first PowerPoint.
Yes, actually some of them are very PowerPoint-y, the transitions from one scene to another. And there's
pixels on this one.
Oh boy, I can make the image.
Swipe from the left.
You wouldn't believe some of these. There'll be a compilation someday. I'd recommend the film. It's an enjoyable watch. It's quite funny. Mm. It does a lot. It's very big, so sometimes the comedy doesn't always land. But nevertheless, I found it to be, quite entertaining. A little saucy in places, which is good fun. It certainly wasn't my favourite sort of lesbian buddy movie, romance movie of the month.
Yeah. Fair enough.
Yeah. Now.
Uh-huh.
Let's talk about the movie we've all been waiting for.
Yeah.
A movie that we've both seen.
Yeah.
That everyone's talking about.
Yeah.
About a woman who falls in love with a fighter who wants to help her cause, but might be a little crazy and take things too far, starting a war that neither of them will be able to control.
Love Lies Bleeding.
Yes, it is. It's a fun new game for all the family. How much can you make something sound like Dune and not be Dune? So you're going to have to help me with this one, because yes, we have. Let's get some character names and such going on, shall we?
Mm-hmm.
We've got, character name of Kristen Stewart.
Mm-hmm.
Playing herself. Kristen Stewart plays Lou. She's a gym manager who is eccentrically awkward, if you can imagine Kristen Stewart playing such a role.
What? No. Never.
What? That garrulous fiend. She's
such a cad.
She runs into Jackie, played by Katie O'Brien, who is a bodybuilder from out of town on her way to a big bodybuilding fair, a convention of
competition.
Together, they end up sort of bonding. Jackie finds out a little bit about Lou's life, including her father. Lou Sr., just realized this is his name. That's great. Yep. Played by Ed Harris. Who is something of a villain. And, you know, she's also got a difficult situation with her sister, played by Jenna Malone, and her husband, played by Dave Franco. Mm-hmm. And all these things sort of coalesce into a crazy situation, a sort of thriller, Coen-esque thriller of, you know, murder, violence, and various other things. So, yeah, we have, on directing duties, we have Rose Glass, who recently made a big splash with St. Maud, and does a similar thing here of offering a very subjective point of view. You get these wonderful fantasy sequences from our two leads in which they perceive reality as being quite different than it is.
Yeah.
In a way that is just as stylistically odd as Driveway Dolls, but far more congruent and successful.
Yeah.
And thrilling and exciting. Yeah. Amazing performances from our leads. Kristen Stewart is a masterclass in awkwardness. Entire lines that are just meaningless sounds that articulate so much. Just a masterclass of mumbling and stuttering.
Yeah.
Which I truly hope to learn from. Katie O'Brien, meanwhile, is just this monumental titaness character that is just fabulous to watch, glorious to watch, endlessly sort of engaging. And as she sort of goes off the rails, it becomes very frightening and quite upsetting because you've invested quite a bit in her and you want her to be who you know her to be. Yeah. And then Ed Harris as the dad is so frightening, and yet also the moments where he shows warmth, you suddenly get the sense of charisma from him that is quite irresistible. It's a very interesting role for him that I think he's very good at playing, but he's put more humanity into this than quite a few of his more recent villainous roles, which is an interesting decision. And it's just this beautiful movie about two people who have gone through a lot learning to trust each other and killing a whole bunch of people on the way. So I really enjoyed this one.
Yeah, me too. Yeah. It's funny. It's sexy.
We didn't mention how hot it is. I didn't mention how hot it is.
It's very hot. It's I can say it and it won't come across as creepy at all. It's hot. So in the run up to seeing this, Paul Salt gathered a group of us together. It was quite
nice. Who's us, Jen?
A group of your queers. Just gather them all
together.
All
my favourite ones.
All your favourites who said yes to watching this.
Immediately. Well, almost immediately.
Almost immediately. I wavered because I'd seen the poster multiple times. I'd seen the trailer.
Really had a good see of that.
I had seen the trailer. I'd seen reviews.
Yes.
Preview reviews of people talking about how gory it was and shocking.
Oh, no. Yeah.
And scary. Well, maybe not scary wasn't the word, but definitely people threw around the word gore quite a bit.
Which is a little disservice-y. There were two moments.
I think so. Yes. So, so I'm a wimp, right? So I was like, I've already said yes to this ticket because I was wavering. It meant going across the entire country to go watch this film down in London with Paul. But Paul said, hey, what if Kristen Stewart's there?
And I was
buy me a ticket, baby. Anyway.
Sorry about that.
No, it's fine. I'm glad I came. But as it approached, I started to get this real like panic about actually seeing it because all the reviews were coming out and talking about all the gore. And I kept, every couple of days, I'd refresh the family guide on IMDb. And then some trooper, three days before the day we saw it, updated that family guide. So I read it and I'm like, great, now I know what to expect. And then it happened in the film and I did look away during
the big bit. Yeah.
But then they do show that same injury on screen a few times and it's funny.
Like, yeah.
I don't like gore, but they really miss. If you're put off by the fact that this has gore in it.
Yeah.
Yes, some violent scenes, but if you can watch something like Dexter.
Yeah.
Where it's like, it's gore, but in a pulpy, slightly schlocky, sometimes played like for a laugh kind
Paul
of
Verhoeven
way.
Kind of.
I don't know. Can't compare that. But
fair.
It is kind of, or just read the IMDb family guide and then you'll be fine.
Yeah.
You'll know exactly what to expect. For me, it's just like, I can't watch a film where someone at some point might pick up, like, someone could just be chopping carrots and I'm like, oh no. There's violence in this film. Someone's going to get stabbed with that knife. And then they don't. And I'm like, why did you do that to me?
There is one moment of violence that kind of is very, by surprise, kind of happens right in the middle of the sequence that you don't expect.
I looked it up, though, Paul. Yes. So I knew it was coming. And you know what? I could sense that this was who it was going to happen to because I'd looked it up. And I'm like, fair. I know. I know what's going to happen here.
Yeah.
And there is some shocking. There is gore.
Yeah.
But it's not. Unless you're truly a wuss and can't see any blood ever, like, truly without passing out.
Yeah.
And I'm pretty wussy. You'll be fine. You'll have a lot of fun. And it's funny. You're genuinely laughing at it.
No, it played wonderfully to the big crowd. We were in a sold-out crowd. It was like, I think it might have been the London premiere.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, and it was just, it played so well. Mm-hmm. Everybody was laughing. Everybody was enjoying it. It was, yeah, everyone was sort of titillated by it. It was a very feisty crowd and part of BFI Flair as well, which yes. is always worth engaging with. There won't be an episode this year because that's the only one I managed to see this year.
Fair enough.
But yes, definitely check out Love Slice Bleeding. Five stars.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. I had a lot of fun with that film. It's a fun time.
It's a fun time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's beautiful.
Well, that's it. I'm done.
Okay, great night.
Night.
You've been listening to Jen and the Film Critic. My name was Jen Blundell, and with me was Paul Salt. Say goodbye, Paul Salt.
June 2 was... Okay. June Part 2. Denis Villeneuve takes us back to Arrakis in order to continue the adventures of Paul Atreides, played by Timothy Chalamet, as he tries to fit in with the new tribe of Fremen that he and his mother, played by Rebecca Ferguson, have now become a part of. He soon falls in love with one of the Fremen, Stilgar, played by Javier Bardem,
and as we all do,
receives excellent tutelage from Chani, played by Zendaya. All together, they sort of fight back against the evil Harkonnens, led by Vladimir Harkonnen, played by... What's your name? You were in Mamma Mia. You're in everything.
Stellan Skarsgård.
Yes, please. Thank you. Yeah, Stellan Skarsgård. I chose that as the film I felt like would most likely conjure the name for you, but...
No, I just was like, which one's called Vladimir?
Yeah, his name's Vladimir.
Oh, right.
Led by Stellan Skarsgård's Vladimir Harkonnen and his nephew.
Raban,
yes, but also...
Yes, and also Fade Ralpha.
Yes, yeah. Played by Dave Bautista and Austin Butler, respectively.
Mm-hmm.
So, beautiful. That's the premise. We saw it. I've seen it 3 times now at the IMAX.
Wow.
Just 3?
Yeah.
Yeah, just 3. how did you find it?
It's amazing.
It's incredible.
It's very, very good.
It's absolutely extraordinary. There's a moment very early on where... In the incredible opening sequence, they're being hunted by these Harkonnen soldiers. And fearing Wormsign, the Harkonnens make for higher ground. They run up a sand dune, and then as they're running, they just continue to ascend, their legs hanging limp as they soar through the sky. And the score makes this the most the score and camera makes this the most terrifying thing you've ever seen.
Yeah.
Back in 1978... The first Superman movie sold itself as, "You will believe a man can fly." It was saying the special effects in this movie are so good, you will actually believe that Christopher Reeve can fly through the air. Since then, we've had so much of people flying through the air that it has lost all sense of spectacle. And yet, this movie makes you feel like you're watching people fly, and it's incredible again.
Absolutely.
It's a movie that makes special effects exciting again when we've all become incredibly bored of special effects.
Yeah.
It just...
Yeah, hugely.
Aesthetically, the movie is gorgeous. Some of the cinematography is so inventive and exciting. The entire sequence set on the Harkonnen homeworld, Gedi Prime with its sun that inverts color and sort of provides a negative is just breathtaking. Oh God, it's a movie where every sequence that starts is one that I'm excited to see again. Yeah. Some of the expressive imagery, like Paul, when he's first setting up his trap to attract a worm, and it's just a screen entirely of sand with this single black outline of a figure in the center of the frame. And it just looks stunning. Yeah. Some of the most breathtaking imagery you've ever seen. And even just sitting here thinking about it and describing it, all I'm thinking is, can I go and see it one last time before it leaves cinemas? And I love the fact that not only has this movie proven to be a hit, but it has proven to be a hit in IMAX. People are recognizing that there is one way to see this movie, and it is not at home. It is not on your phone. It is in the biggest screen that you can find. It is huge spectacle that I don't know if it has a colleague in that sense. I imagine a lot of people would point towards Avatar, but I don't like those movies, so
no,
this one for me stands alone and I adore it.
Yeah, it's fantastic. Absolutely superb.
Yeah.
Just everything about it.
Yeah.
The performances, the costume design, the special effects, the pacing of the story, the music, the colour palettes.
Yes.
The just the everything.
Yeah.
It's just fantastic. It's just such a perfect adaptation of what is a challenging book to adapt.
Absolutely it is.
It's just really, you just can't help but marvel at the skill of it.
Yeah. Absolutely. It's yeah, simply breathtaking. And you're right, like it works so well in so many ways. It's very funny. It's a movie that has a good sense of humor, surprisingly.
Yeah.
It's a movie that has great thrills, great scares, even some eroticism. Care of the sort of relationship between Zendaya and Timothée Chalamet, and everything that Léa Seydoux is doing.
Yeah.
In her just screen time.
Just being herself.
Just being her and the wonderful things that entails. This is a fabulous film. If it doesn't end up being my favorite film of the year, I will be amazed at whatever else it is, because, this is just staggering.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Good stuff.
And that's why it reminded me a lot of The First Omen. That's right. That's what we were really building to. Review it again, Monkey Boy. Like Monkey Man. My God, we've talked about a lot of movies.
Yeah, we have. And yet, still come in on less than 2 hours.
Yeah.
I swear we've done... I'm proud of you, Paul.
I'm proud of us.
Yeah.
And I hope that you are too, listeners.
Yeah.
Jen, how can people find out how to be prouder of us?
Well, they can find out by going to Screen Mayhem on your social medias, screenmayhem.com. And there you can find Paul's lovely written reviews for a couple of the films that we talked about today and probably and some older films and some other things and the Screen Mayhem stuff. There's a variety of things on Screen Mayhem. Go there, check it out. If you want to get in touch with us, you can email us at filmcriticpodcast@gmail.com. Our theme music was by Jacob Blundell. This was Jen and the Film Critic. My name was Jen Blundell, and with me was my film critic Paul Salt. Say goodbye, Paul Salt.
Goodbye. I was Fade Ralpher. I was doing Fade Ralpher.
Fade Ralpher.
What must we do? What we do? What do we do? What do we do? What was it? I had to drown you in that tub. I enjoy this passage. Tub. Goodbye, everyone. See you in the tub.
Goodbye. See you in the tub.